I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
I was sailing for 2.5 weeks. They're in due west and making 9 knots. I should have been in Fiji in less than a week. Well, the first piece of land I saw wasn't Fiji, was it? No. No, it was here, this island. And you know why? Because this is it. This is all there is left. This ocean and this place here. We are stuck in a bloody snow globe.
I was really surprised in the book that there are a lot of these lost lands, forgotten realms here in the United States. And the one I first wanted to ask you about was this Kingdom of Prince Madoc in Alabama, because you say of all the places in the book, that one seems to be the most possible to be real. I hope I got that right.
You have indeed. And to be perfectly honest, Tim, that's one of my favorites, because we're talking about a medieval Welsh kingdom from about the 12th century, which existed in southern Alabama. And we do know that during the middle of the 12th century, Wales was in great turmoil. There was a kingdom which was known as Gwynedd, which is in South Wales, which was incredibly in upheaval around about 1137. That was because Owen Gwynedd, who was the king there, had so many sons. The old Celtic chieftains had a considerable number of sons, and it was great to have so many sons. But whenever you died, it created all sorts of problems because the sons claimed your kingship. And there, we do know that one of the sons of Owen Gwynedd fled into the west to avoid the wars which were going on in his kingdom. And he was Prince Madoc. And it is thought that he sailed westwards and dropped anchor in Mobile Bay in southern Alabama. And that he founded a kingdom there. He returned to Wales, it is said, very briefly. We don't know whether he actually did return or not. And then took more people back with him and settled. Now, the story which I like is that around about 1660, a Welsh missionary was captured by a branch of the Tuscarora Indians and was about to be killed. He began to pray in Welsh and was answered in Welsh by one of the tribal elders, who said that it was their sacred language and was the language of Madog, who was a king among the ancient Indians. Now, Madoc had come from Wales and settled in southern Alabama. And I think there is a river which flows near the Alabama River near Mobile, which is called the Mad Dog River, M-A-D, separate word, D-O-G. And that may well be a derivation of Madoc. Now, when the Spanish came in the 1500s and came up the Mobile or the Alabama River north of Mobile, they found the ruins of ancient forts. Now, one of the forts which they found actually matches to some extent, to a great extent, I should say, the layout of Carnarvon Castle in Wales. And it is possible that it was built by Welsh stonemasons. So there may well have been a Welsh living in America long before Columbus, 300 years before Columbus arrived.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely one of the coolest ones in the book. And
I like it.
It really makes you think about some of these. Talk a little bit about the search for El Dorado that really ruined the life of Coronado, I think. I forget his name.
The great Coronado, a governor of New Galicia. Coronado set out to find a great city. Now, I don't know if you have seen a film which is doing the rounds over here called National Treasure, starring Nicolas Cage, in which they go in search of El Dorado, which is somewhere beneath Mount Rushmore. I can tell you that El Dorado doesn't exist beneath Mount Rushmore. But whenever I was growing up, El Dorado was supposed to exist somewhere in the Mato Grosso in the South American jungle. Now, I have to say, for a start, Tim, that El Dorado is not a city. It is a person, because El Dorado means the gilded man, and possibly refers to ancient Aztec chieftains who smeared themselves in gold and threw themselves into a lake. But there were talk of cities somewhere in America. And this is what Coronado set out to discover. He had been led by a monk called Marco Steniza, who had heard various stories from shipwrecked sailors of the seven cities of Cibola. Now, Cibola appears in the film simply as one city. There were actually seven cities. Mm-hmm. And he set out to find them because one was made of gold and had been mined from the mountains. So he marched across from New Galicia, which is in northern Mexico, and he marched across the southwestern United States, and he found nothing. His men were devastated by disease and by desertions and by hunger and thirst. So whenever he crossed the Wichita River, he had been told that the cities actually existed on the other side of the Wichita River, and he found nothing but a number of mud villages, and he turned back. But the myth of seven cities, for instance, there was also a story that Romans, in the final days of the Roman Empire, had fled to America. It wasn't called America, but they had fled there, and they had established cities there. And this was supposed to be part of the lost cities in America. So the story of the great cities continued to exist and were given a sort of fresh impetus when the French explorer Mahout stepped out of the jungles of Cambodia and into the main street of a vastly overgrown city, which was the Angkor Wat, which was the city of the Khmers, which had been lost for about 500 or 600 years. And so that fed into the national consciousness, and they said, well, if these cities are lying out in the Cambodian Vietnamese jungles, could they not also be lying out in the South American jungles? And so the notion of El Dorado, the city of gold, the gilded man, if you like, was there and drew explorers and all sorts of people to try and discover where they were. And there were expeditions which were lost trying to find them.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be on one of these expeditions.
I would not. But, I mean, at this time, Tim, the South American jungle was still one of the great unexplored areas of the earth.
Yeah.
And people were being drawn to the notion of wealth, to the ideal. And whenever I was growing up, the notion of El Dorado was that it was a futuristic city, which somehow lay in the South American jungle.
One story that I wanted you to talk about is The Search for the Fountain of Youth by Ponce de Leon. And I found it really interesting that was less about a physical rejuvenation and redemption and more about a political rejuvenation for him.
Absolutely. Well, as I was saying, a lot of the notions of searching for these places is actually more than a physical search. It's trying to find ideals. It's trying to find new perspectives. This actually ties in with the quest for immortality, which is a very, very old quest, which goes back actually into prehistoric times with the Sons of Partholon. For instance, there were people here in Ireland, Geraldus Cambrensis, who was Gerald of Wales, who was a very learned monk, wrote that there was a lake or a fountain in Ireland where if a man washed his hair, be he white as snow, it would return to its natural color. Now, I have been looking for that, Tim, for many years and still haven't found it. He'd obviously never heard of Grecian 2000. And, of course, you get the notion of healing and all from the water, and I mention in the book the Pool of Bethsaida in the Bible. The quest for immortality, the quest for healing, had always been a great quest. And Ponce de Leon, had thought that the fountain itself might lie in a place called Bimini. Now, Bimini was is a couple of islands. There's Grand Bimini and Lesser Bimini. And it was held by the Spanish at a time. There's very little there now. But it had originally been held by the Arawaks. And the Arawaks had a legend that there was a fountain which a great chieftain had discovered and had was still living on the island because he had lived forever. Now, De Leon had been actually one of the first governors of Cuba, which was one of the territories which had been ascribed to Christopher Columbus. Now, Columbus's son, Diego, went to the court in Madrid and asked if all his lands, the lands that his father had claimed, could be returned to the family. And the court ruled in his favor, which meant that De Leon, as governor, was out of a job. And so he tried to revive his fortunes by setting out on an expedition to find the Fountain of Youth following the old Arawak legends. He found nothing on Bimini, but he was driven ashore and landed on the American coast. And he landed there on the Feast of Flowers, which was just before Easter. And he named the area that he had landed on after the Feast of Flowers. He called it Florida. And he had thought that somewhere in the hinterland of Florida lay the Fountain of Youth. He didn't know about Disney World, but he set out to find the fountain, but he didn't find it. If he had found the Fountain of Youth, he claimed, or he imagined, that his political fortunes would be restored. He had once been a very influential figure in the Caribbean, but now with the rise of the Columbuses, he found himself out of favor. So this was actually an attempt to restore his own political fortunes by basing it around a legend.
Yeah.
Now, there was rumors that Bimini itself had been the site of a great civilization. And that may be the case because divers have found the remnants of a great causeway, which made the great writer Edgar Casey write that Bimini was the center of this civilization and drew attention to the Bimini Road, which the divers had discovered. So we don't know. There may have been something there. There may not have been something there. But De Leon tried to use the Fountain of Youth to regain his political fortune. However, he failed and died more or less in poverty.
Yeah, it's a strange story, one you don't really hear about in the history books here in America.
Well,
you just hear that he was
there. You are.
The youth. Yeah.
He gave you Florida.
I'm not sure if I should thank him. There wasn't anything in the book here about the Grand Canyon as far as the lost city in there, and I thought I'd heard something about that. I was going to ask you if you had.
Well, now, this follows a whole number of old legends. Now, there's supposed to be lost cities. If you travel about the American Southwest, almost up into the mid area, you will find stories of lost cities. Most of these come from Spanish incursions, and it was what we were talking about earlier with the legend of El Dorado, because they were supposed to be the cities of the seven patriarchs, which were, as I said, about people, some of them said they were Christians, who fled from Rome to avoid persecutions, or emperors who are people connected to the Caesars who fled from Rome whenever the Ostrogoths and the Goths sacked Rome in the 500s and fled to America and set up cities. The Spaniards, of course, when they traveled, they saw great rock formations. It comes back to, once again, what we were talking about much earlier. Well, whenever you look out at the horizon and see massive rock formations and so on, they begin to look like cities. There are areas in Montana, for example, like the Devil's Towers,
yeah,
stuff like that, which from a distance may look like the spires of a great city. And many of the early Spaniards, whenever they arrived in what was for them unknown and unfamiliar territory where anything could be lurking, they saw these things way in the distance and they ascribed them to lost cities and marked them on maps. In many cases, they didn't travel to them right away, but they marked them on maps so that others could follow them. Of course, nothing was ever found. And the Grand Canyon is one, because the Grand Canyon is quite a spectacular place with all sorts of rocks and hidden bits and pieces to it. And the early explorers said, well, you know, there's probably something there. It's so bizarre, it's so awe-inspiring, it's so strange to us that there has to be something there. And so the legends grew up, and there's all sorts of legends of cities and all sorts of legends of strange peoples and all sorts of things which came out of the early Spanish exploration.
Now, I thought I had heard that they was doing some exploring or something in the Grand Canyon in the 1930s or something like that, and it was in National Geographic, and they had found something, but then it was never really mentioned again. Do you know anything about that?
Well, now, there might well be, because there were very early Indians who were called mound dwellers, who began to build great things which were like sort of, and the only way I can describe it is primitive skyscrapers, mm-hmm. because they went up and down. So that may be something. I'm not terribly familiar with that. I did hear, a bit like yourself, Tim, I did hear something about it, but that may be followed up in another book.
Nice. Excellent. Good. Another of the stories I wanted to explore here with you was one that was described in great detail in the book and was really interesting, especially because it was just so detailed and the account of the story was so well put together, and that's the Green Children.
Indeed. The Green Children were originally from St. Martin's Land, or so they claimed. Now, we're beginning to move from the upper lands of the earth to the subterranean world, because people looked down into great holes and chasms and caves and said, I wonder if there's something down there as well. There were stories of lands under the earth. But the Green Children stands out among them because there seems to be some sort of connections and some sort of historical. They appeared in England in the 11th century at a time when England was in the throes of civil war between King Stephen and the Empress Matilda. And they turned up at the castle of a local knight. There was a boy and a girl, and they claimed to have come from a land called St. Martin's Land, which lay under people's feet. The land of St. Martin's Land was not all that different from the land which they found themselves in, except that the people had green skin. I mean, the people farmed, the people lived in houses, they had cattle and pigs. But the boy and the girl were tending their father's sheep, and they had heard the sound of a bell, and they had followed it, and they had climbed a way up, higher and higher, and they had come up through a hole, which had been, I think, created by a storm where a tree had been uprooted. Mm-hmm. And they had come out, and they had been captured by some people on the surface and taken to the castle of a local knight called Sir Richard de Colne. They spoke, it is said, in a high fluting language which was very unlike guttural Middle English. They refused to eat any meat which was set before them because the people of St. Martin's Land were believed to be vegetarians. But they did get stuck into a massive basket of green beans. Now, the knight, Sir Richard, adopted them as his own and kept them in the castle. And the girl thrived. The girl seemed to get on tremendously well, although it is said in the old text that she was a bit promiscuous. The boy didn't. The boy became very moody and moped about. After a while, he died. He didn't like the upper. The girl actually married. Once they had stayed on the surface for a while, the green hue in their skin began to decrease. But the girl actually married and shortly after disappeared. As I said, that she went back, I mean, she may have gone back to St. Martin's Land under our feet. The thing is very detailed in a history of England. It is given as occurring during the either the reign of Stephen, who died in 1154, or during the reign of King Henry II, 1154 to 1189. It is thought that they came from a place called St. Mary by the Wolf Pits, which was a place near the great cathedral at Bury in England, and that the hole that they had come up with and to which the girl is supposed to have returned was in Thetford Forest. Now, we literally don't know about whether or not she went back to an underground world. There are some claim she did and some claim she didn't. What I found interesting was that in roughly about 1887 in Spain, in a place called Banshos, two green children also appeared, and they had come out of a large cave which had been uncovered. Well, it had been recently sealed, but it had been pulled out again by a landslide. And they were dressed in long gown-like clothes of an unknown material and spoke in a strange fluting language. They both claimed to come from a place called San Martino, which is St. Martin's Land. So I find that very interesting. I mean, the green children in England, there have been a whole number of explanations to it, in which people have suggested that the green tinge was some sort of sickness from which the children suffered, and that they actually came from the Suffolk village of Fornham St. Martin's, and had been caught up in the rebellion against King Stephen, and had wandered under tin mines from which they had got this sort of hue to their skins. But it doesn't actually explain what happened in Spain. I have found that a very, very interesting and a very, very, as you say, very, very detailed.
Yeah, yeah, and you actually beat me to the punch there on the Spanish story, because that's what I found really intriguing, because if it was just the one-off story from the medieval times, you could kind of write it off, but then the story reemerges in a new setting, and 700 years later, it's a little too coincidental. I don't know what to make of it.
That is indeed.
Now, what about, there's a location here that I wanted to ask you about that's not in the book. It's less of a lost land than, I guess you could say, an infamous location, and that would be the Alexandrian Library. Do you know much about that area?
The Alexandrian Library. It was supposed to be a great library. It was a great library in what is now the Liberian, the Libyan, sorry, the Libyan, capital of Alexandria. And it was supposed to be a great library. Alexandria was a port, and people traveled to it because it was a major city. And great scholars, great philosophers. Now, there was a library there which had a very unique lending policy. You could only get access to the scrolls, because there were no books there, it was all scrolls and things like that, if you brought something of your own and deposited it in the library. And so the library became a great repository of knowledge, but it was on the African coast, and it was continually being sacked because the city was such an important and such a wealthy city, it was continually being sacked by raiders. And so the great library at Alexandria was destroyed, and I have no doubt that the library did exist. And all that wealth, all the wealth of the ages, because the library continued for quite a considerable time, is now lost to us, which is a great, great shame.
Yeah, it's a heartbreaking story, and one that is that you don't hear too much about nowadays.
You don't, mainly because Libya is not a sort of politically correct country at the moment under Colonel Gaddafi.
Exactly, yeah. Let me see. There's only one other story I wanted you to tell here. The Shepherd of the Hills.
Oh, the Shepherd of the Hills in North Carolina.
Yeah, this was a fascinating story and one that resonates because it's rather contemporary in, you know, in relation to a lot of the other stories. It has a lot of detail to it. And raises a lot of interesting questions because there's such a vanishing aspect to it.
I should point out that North Carolina has always interested me because there are supposedly what are called, well, there are what are called bolds. These are places where no grass will grow. Near the town of Raleigh, there is a place called the Devil's Tramping Ground. And I make reference to places like Whiteside Mountain and the Devil's Courthouse. These are all associated with the enemy of mankind. But the Reverend Hawkins was a well-known minister and a well-known figure in North Carolina, in the Sapphire Hills. And he was living with his son-in-law, the Reverend W.D. At that time he was 73. He was a retired Methodist minister. We're talking about a time in the 1930s. And he went out into, it's on the North Carolina-South Carolina border. Tom Hawkins was known as the Shepherd of the Hills, and he set out to try and find a lost steer, which had wandered up into the hills, which belonged to his son-in-law. It was a blustery night, and his son-in-law had just come in, and the steer was gone, and he said, look, I'll go out and try and find that. And they went out, and he disappeared. Now, there are allegedly stories that, a bit like the balls, nothing will grow on these, but they are supposedly entrances to another world, which lies beneath us. And it was thought that Tom Hawkins was carried away by people who came up from the from down below and had a scout about, and he stumbled across them, and they took him back underground with them. Now, that's a contemporary story, and it's an old, it has all the qualities of an old folktale, but nobody has ever been able to explain, and this is in the 1930s, which, as you quite rightly say, is a relatively modern thing. No one has ever been able to explain what happened to Tom Hawkins. He may be, and they found queer marks on the ground where he, as if he had been dragged along. So one never knows. Whenever you go up into the North Carolina, South Carolina border country, be very careful because there's goblin lights on the ridges and strange fires burning in the hollows.
Yeah, it's strange. What about any mysterious locations here in Massachusetts that I should be worried about? Anything I should be concerned about?
There are supposed to be entrances to other worlds in Massachusetts, particularly in the Salem area.
Really?
Which was at the time of the witches. There was supposed to be all sorts of things come out of Round Hills. Remember that Round Massachusetts and there was where H.P. Lovecraft said some of his stories about things from the other world coming up and carrying off people. So don't go swimming around Ipswich or anything like that.
I'll try not. I'm not much of a swimmer as it is, so we'll be okay.
Well, I can't swim at all. So.
Well, talk a little bit about these illustrations in the book that are done by Ian Daniels. They're amazing too. They're fantastic drawings and really captivating stuff.
The idea for the book came to me, Tim, and I have to be quite honest, standing at my sink. because in my kitchen, because where I stand in my kitchen, I am looking over the River Ban into the oldest continuously inhabited place in Ireland, which dates back to 7000 BC. Ian and I have known each other for quite some time. Ian lives in Maidstone in Kent, and I rang Ian and I said, look, I've got this idea. Well, he says, if we can do it, he says, I'll illustrate it for you. And we corresponded, we talked, and we corresponded by email. And he kept sending me down stuff, and I kept saying, Ian, that's magnificent. We'll go with that. So I kept sending him the text. He kept sending me back stuff, and that was how the illustrations came about. What you don't see, Tim, in the book is the color, because he sent me down the illustrations in color, and the colors are staggering. I'm trying to persuade New Page to do a color version of this.
That would be cool. I'd like to see that.
It would.
And I'm looking here at some of your other books. Talk a little bit just about some of these other books you've written, because you have quite a bibliography of stuff.
Oh, I have. I'll talk to you some of the other stuff I've done for Career. The Career contacted me at one time and said, how would you like to do a thing on vampires? In actual fact, I'm doing a thing now for Career on The Walking Dead. But we did a thing on vampires, and we began to look at vampires around the world. And everybody thinks that vampires are either a bit like Christopher Lee with the great cloak and the burning eyes, or else like something out of Buffy. And vampires appear in every culture. I mean, you have a Vietnamese vampire who is nothing more than a floating head and who drinks through extended antennae which come out of its nose. You have things in the Philippines called aswang who drink through their tongue. My favorite, of course, is the Albanian Sampiro. Albanian Sampiro is actually a dead person of Turkish descent, because the Turks and the Albanians don't get on tremendously well. And there's a lot of xenophobia and stuff like that. But this walks about wrapped in a shroud on high heels, with large eyes, making kissing noises. I think I may have seen one of those down the town not so long ago. You wouldn't get them in Massachusetts.
Oh, well, I'm afraid they're probably everywhere.
There are. The only thing which I've done is the Encyclopedia of the Undead, which looks at a number of things like werewolves and zombies. I mean, I'm actually writing on voodoo at the minute, so I'll maybe come back at some stage and talk to you about voodoo and about the undead and about vampires and about everything.
Absolutely. I would love that. I would love
that. No problem, Tim.
And have you looked much at the whole Hollow Earth? Because that's kind of a lost land thing.
That was what we began to look at in Lost Lands, because there are, for those of you your listeners who are not familiar with the theory, there is a theory that the Earth is not in fact solid; it is actually hollow. I mean, that was also part of a Nazi philosophy, and that it can be accessed. The interior world can be accessed at both the North and South Poles. There were also expeditions by the Nazis to find some sort of polar route, because it was also said that in the 1950s and 60s, that some of what we call today flying saucers do not originate from other planets, but from a civilization within the Hollow Earth. And there's a lot of stories about interior lands down in the center of the world. As I was saying earlier, probably men looked into the deep dark holes and chasms and whatever of the world and said, I wonder what's down there. And you get stories in the 1960s, the big films were things like Doug McClure. You'd be far too young to remember Doug McClure. And Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth, where he had a big boring machine and went down and discovered descendants of ancient civilizations living under the earth. And I suppose there is still a fear that perhaps down in the dark beneath us, there's something lurking that's coming up that might come up on savages. So whenever you go around Massachusetts and all, be very careful.
Well, I try to. I try to stay out of trouble, but trouble finds
good
me.
Good man.
Just a side note, have you ever seen the program Lost? It's sort of kind of right in this wheelhouse of Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms.
It is, but it's a program. I've written about vampires, but I have actually, Tim, never watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I tell a lie, I watched one and turned it off halfway through. I haven't watched Lost. I did try to get into it at one stage, but I found it so complex, because you needed to know what was going on, and there were so many surreal turns and stuff that I didn't know. But I'll give it another go on your recommendation, Tim.
Oh, totally, definitely. And it was amusing because when I was reading the book, so many of these locations have been offered by viewers of the show and trying to figure it out. You know, they think it's Lemuria or they think it's Atlantis, and it's like, it's pretty cool that connection.
There you are. Maybe they'll hire me as a script writer.
I hope so.
Yeah.
That would be great. So now you kind of teased I think you said an undead book coming out.
Oh, yes. We have, now this is for Career Press, once again, on New Page, who are the publishers of Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms, so I'd better give them a plug. We're doing Walking with the Walking Dead, and we're beginning to look at notions of resurrection, notions of people coming back from the grave, and how that has come into our culture. We're looking at things like zombies, we're looking at mummies, we're looking at the Gothic heritage and stuff like, and the Muravyo, which is the Celtic Walking Dead, and the living mummies of Japan. So we're looking at all that, and that book should be out in the fall, I think. I'm doing a whole series of things. Maybe I shouldn't be talking about this. I have a new book of folk tales coming out. I have a new book about Ireland, about witches and ghosts in Ireland, which is, I've just got the stuff this morning, and it's being brought out by Barnes & Noble. So we're working at all sorts of things, Tim.
Awesome. Sounds good. Well, now that I've read this first book here, my first book from you that I've read, Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms, I'm going to be looking into your catalog and digging into your bibliography because I was so impressed with this book. I can't wait to see what else you
got. Well, have a look. You can find a lot of the stuff I do on Amazon.
And you don't have a website or anything?
I'm talking about putting up a website. At the minute, Tim, I'm writing, I'm teaching, I'm setting up community development here and in Japan and places like that. And I'm trying to get around to developing a website because it's the way we do business nowadays, and possibly by the end of the year.
I hope so. Yeah, that would be great. Is there a way for people to get in touch with you?
Yep.
You want that sort of thing?
Well, look, I'd give them an email address because that's always the best way to get in contact with me. I'm here, there, and everywhere. The email is, and this is all one word, and it's all lowercase, and if they don't get it, I mean, you have it as well.
Yeah.
It's drbobcurran at yahoo.co.uk.
There you go. Perfect.
There you go. They can drop me a line.
Where can people pick up the book?
Oh, they can get it at all good booksellers. They're selling it all across America. And they can get it on Amazon.
Excellent. Yes, definitely. If they don't have it at the bookstore, request it or go home and get on the computer and order it from Amazon.
Absolutely.
Is a must-read book. I'm telling you, folks, you got to pick it up. Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms. It's outstanding. I can't put it over enough. I enjoyed it so much. As soon as I started reading it, it was just like, you can't put it down. It's amazingly well written. It's tremendously researched. People who know about the esoteric have heard about so many of these places, like Atlantis and Lemuria and Davy Jones' Locker, Shangri-La, and you only sort of kind of hear about them, and this book really fleshes them out, that you really learn so much more about these locations and really their origins and their evolution over time. So I can't commend you enough for putting together such a tremendous book, and I can't thank you enough here for coming on the show, and all the way from Northern Ireland. I know it's the evening there. It's only the afternoon here, so I'm doing okay.
You're okay. It's half eight. at night here.
Like I said, Bob, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show.
And it was a pleasure. And it was lovely to talk to you and lovely to talk to your listeners.
That does it for this week's edition of BOA Audio Season 3. Big, big, super huge thanks to Dr. Bob Curran for coming on the show. As I said numerous times in the interview, I highly recommend his book, Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms. It is a definite must-read for any serious student of the world of esoterica. It really gives you a chance to find out much more information about a lot of these esoteric locations that have previously really only existed in the shadows and rumor mills of esoterica. Of course, you can reach him at the following email address, drbobcurran@yahoo.co.uk. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio listener feedback. And this week's letter comes from Johnny Wishoff. That's his name, my friends, Johnny Wishoff. And here's what he has to say. Hey, and thanks for a great site. My name is Johnny Wishoff. I'm a musician and have a project in the psi field of trance. In psi trance and psychedelic, speeches and quotes from people are often used, and I found your shows very inspiring, so I couldn't resist using some of it on my new tracks for this project. Are you open to letting me use your stuff? All material used is pro-BOA, though I've edited a bit, the meaning is the same or even stronger. Hope you guys are cool with it and keep up the fantastic work. Best wishes, Johnny Wishoff. You'll be happy to know that I wrote Johnny back and let him know that of course he could use some clips from BOA in his musical projects as long as he let us know what was going on with that, kept us updated on it, and hopefully we'll have something cool here to play for you at BOA in the not-too-distant future, some psy trance music with BOA mixed in, courtesy of Johnny Wishoff. I wish him the best of luck with his project and look forward to seeing what he's come up with, mixing some BOA in with some psychedelic music. If you'd like to be a part of BOA Audio listener feedback, there's a couple ways to do it. Either write to boaaudio@hotmail.com or simply go to banalofamerica.com and click the contact button. Either one of those methods puts your correspondence in the inbox for BOA Audio listener feedback. Up next, it is the thanks portion of the show. We are very close to getting BOA Audio After Hours up and running, and soon you'll be hearing from these folks, but until then, let me just give them the thanks. Of course, I'm talking about the outstanding BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, R. Lee, Joe V., Tina Senna, and Rochelle Hawks. This crew is top-notch. They are awesome. They definitely carry the load at BOA Mondays through Fridays with their columns. If there's breaking news in the world of esoterica, chances are one of the BOA staff, or more of them, will be covering it. Like we say week in and week out here, folks, I'm kind of repeating myself, but it's definitely worth driving the point home every week. If you're only listening to BOA Audio, and you're not reading the columns at Banal of America, you're only getting half the story. Check out BOA and find out why so many are making it a part of their everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. This week you heard a lengthy phone conversation with Northern Ireland, much like the episode a couple of weeks ago with Christo Lowe. As you can surmise, I'm sure, I had to foot the bill for that hour and a half long phone call to Northern Ireland, much like I had to foot the bill for the 2-hour call to South Africa. These bills add up, my friends, and so here at the end of the program we turn to you and ask you to make a donation to BOA to help us offset the costs of these lengthy international phone calls, and of course the hosting and the bandwidth and all the other associated costs that come along with a program like this. How can you donate? Simple. You go to Banal of America, you click the PayPal button, and you make a donation. You can find the PayPal button on the main page or on the BOA Audio archive page. Click that, it'll take you to PayPal, make a donation. No donation is too small. And all donations go towards keeping BOA Audio and Banal of America up and running and freely available for all of our great listeners and readers the world over. Next week on the program, we're going back to the world of ghosts with an A-list name from the ghost genre, Jeff Belanger, creator of the online juggernaut Ghost Village. We're going to be covering a number of gems from his latest book, Ghost Files, including the various theories on what ghosts are, the commercialization of haunted locations, Jewish exorcisms, Jeff's global travels investigating haunted places, dealing with skeptics, the evolution of orbs, and other fun stuff. We're also going to examine big picture issues from a number of different angles. We're going to cover the explosion in popularity for ghost hunting and esoterica on the internet. Jeff has tremendous first-hand observations and experience on both of these big picture issues, and we're going to, as I said, cover them from a number of angles. It's going to be a fun, loose, and at times frank discussion with a researcher who's at the very top of the wildly popular field that is ghost research. Jeff Belanger, creator of Ghost Village and author of Ghost Files, next week on BOA Audio Season 3. And on that note, we're going to wrap it up for the week. Until you hear from me next time, folks, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.